Today's broadcast was originally recorded on December
3rd, 2024.
Oh boy. Is that South Korea or North Carolina today?
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight.
Take your pick.
I got the feeling that something ain't right.
All right.
I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair. And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
Yes, I am. From Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is the Bradcast, as heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in LA. Also in California, in Red Bluff and Redding on KFOI and Round Mountains KKRN. Up in Oregon on the Central Coast on KYAQ, Cottage Grove's KSO, and Eugene's KEPW. Lanchester, Pennsylvania's W News, Maui, Hawaii's KAKU, in Columbus, Ohio on WGRN, Palinville, New York's WLPP, Rochester, New York's WRFZ. They're going to get a lot of snow. Down in New Orleans on WHIV, out in Gallup, New Mexico on KNIZ, Concord, New Hampshire's WNHN, Fayetteville, Arkansas's KPSQ. In Seattle on KODX, Richmond, Virginia's WRWK, Fairmont, West Virginia's WEFR, Janesville, Wisconsin's WADR, and Minneapolis, St. Paul's AM 950, KTNF. I think they're going to get some snow, too. And we also stream coast to coast and around the globe every day on the internet. On the Progressive Voices channel, Netroots Radio, Radio for Humans, NicoleSandler.com, Radio Free Brooklyn, No Lies Radio, Detour Talk, and most of your favorite podcast sites, Blanketing Planet Earth. I'm Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, and all-around swell fellow, says me, from bradblog.com. Thank you very much for joining us today. I had already planned to cover the pushback against the number of right-wing power grabs that are now underway. Right now in this country, beyond what is happening in Washington with the incoming thuggery of the Trump administration, the power grabs at the state level. And we will cover that in a bit today. But then news broke Desi Doyen to once again shuffle things around today, as usual. How are you doing?
I'm doing okay. It's like power grabs for everyone.
It is indeed. Let's start in South Korea this morning in a story which still has a number of moving parts as we go to air. It's changing quickly, but it seems to me that it might be instructive or at least serve as a bit of a warning or an object lesson for us back here in the United States, perhaps in the coming months and years, amidst our own various power grabs and power struggles in defense of democracy. South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol represents the Conservative People Power Party in South Korea. He has served as the president there since 2022 after winning a presidential election by a razor-thin margin, defeating his rival, the leader of South Korea's opposition Democratic Party, Lee Jae-myung, by less than one percentage point. Is it sounding familiar yet? Yoon, when he won the election, was a newcomer to politics. Since taking office, succeeding the liberal president Moon Jae-in, he has faced a raft of challenges from the permanent threat of North Korea to rising tensions between South Korea's major partners, the U.S. and China. Yoon has long taken a tough stance on North Korea, a shift from his predecessor Moon, who had favored dialogue and peaceful reconciliation with the North. Yoon lambasted that approach as, quote, subservient. He promised to bulk up South Korea's military, even hinting that he would launch a preemptive strike against North Korea if he saw any signs of an offensive being launched against Seoul. but he has faced political battles at home, sparring with the opposition Democratic Party, which has repeatedly impeached ministers and frustrated the government's fiscal plans, you know, as a good opposition party actually does, or at least tries to. In the bargain, with his support of unpopular policies and a steadfast opposition, Yoon has seen his popularity ratings plunge since taking office, thanks to a series of scandals and controversies under his leadership that even prompted hundreds of thousands to call for his impeachment. Okay, now I'm guessing it must sound familiar to everyone by now, right?
It certainly does to me.
So, yeah, well, you know, while I wasn't certain what to make of this story when it first broke on Tuesday morning, as I learned more about it, it quickly felt like it was a lesson and or a warning that maybe we should pay attention to. As CNN and many others are reporting today, South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol declared martial law in a sudden surprise unannounced late night TV address on Tuesday, accusing the country's main opposition party of sympathizing with North Korea and of other anti-state activities. The claims, if I understand them correctly, appear to be absurd. They're based more on Yoon's failing, his falling polling numbers rather than objective reality, that South Korea's Democratic Party is somehow filled with North Korean sympathizers. The last time a South Korean president declared martial law was way back in 1980 during a nationwide uprising led by students and labor unions at the time. After autocracy in the country during the Cold War, South Korea has bounced back and forth between autocracy, liberal democracy, dictatorship, until finally settling into a largely stable democracy in the 80s until now, well, at least until Tuesday. In the surprise announcement, Yoon cited a motion by the opposition Democratic Party, which has a majority in the parliament, to impeach top prosecutors and reject a budget proposal. In other words, his administration faced opposition from the National Assembly. His poll numbers plummeted. And so, in the middle of the night, he declared martial law to effectively shut down the parliament and take over military control of South Korea. Shutting down parliament, of course, was key to his plan, as apparently South Korean law allows the assembly to override a declaration of martial law by the president with a simple majority vote of lawmakers present. Of course, if you declare parliament to be closed and send the military to prevent lawmakers from getting inside the parliament to hold a vote, well, you can keep your autocratic martial law in place because the parliament can't vote to stop it. If the military is not particularly behind your attempted self-coup, and or if lawmakers find a way into parliament anyway, as one such lawmaker was said to have climbed over a fence.
Yes, you
to
can
get
see
into the parliament.
They posted those videos on the internet of them climbing over the fence to get in.
So, yeah, if they could do that, if a lawmaker could climb over a fence to get in, it does not sound like the military tried particularly hard to keep the parliament shut down. And reports from media on site described several troops that appeared frightened by the angry protesters who were trying to get past them. So if the military is not on your side and the parliament is steadfast in their opposition and ready to act quickly to put down such a coup, well, your coup may not work out so well. And as we go to air, that seems to be what is happening in South Korea. After Yoon's declaration, South Korean lawmakers were able to open their 300-member parliament, despite the military there to supposedly stop them. They had enough members to get a quorum. They got 190 members of the 300-member body to vote to block the martial law decree overturning Yoon's measure. The National Assembly chairman, a member of the opposition Liberal Democratic Party, labeled the president's announcement, quote, invalid following the unanimous vote, and called on him to immediately lift the emergency measures. He added, quote, "The people should rest easy. The National Assembly will defend democracy with the people. Must be nice." Under South Korean law, the president is obliged to comply with such a vote. And as of this afternoon, it appears that Yoon has backed down, announcing that he would, in fact, reverse his martial law order following the vote of the National Assembly. As noted, the support from the military seemed weak at best, and even the leader of Yoon's own right-wing party, the so-called People Power Party, had decried the president's resolution to declare martial law. In the declaration, Yoon labeled the Democratic opposition's actions as, quote, "clear anti-state behavior aimed at inciting rebellion." So, you know, kind of like our own rarely used Insurrection Act, which Donald Trump has threatened to use on several occasions, both during his first term in office and, well, we'll see what happens in the days ahead. Yoon described martial law as necessary there, a necessary measure to protect the freedoms and the safety of the people, to ensure the country's sustainability and pass on a stable nation to future generations. So he had to basically destabilize the nation in order to stabilize it. You know how that goes. Again, any of this sounding familiar? The president told the public, quote, "We will eliminate the anti-state forces. We will restore the country to normalcy as quickly as possible," while acknowledging that martial law might cause some inconvenience. He promised efforts to minimize its impact on the public. His decree, according to South Korea's Yonhap News Agency, banned all political and parliamentary activities and allowed arrests without a warrant. The decree also prohibited, quote, "denying free democracy or attempting a subversion," and it outlawed, quote, "fake news." Yes. And, quote, "manipulating public opinion." People who violated that decree, at least according to Yoon's government, could be arrested and raided without the need for a warrant, according to Yonhap. Citing the same document, Reuters reports that strikes, work stoppages, and rallies that incite social chaos are also prohibited. That includes doctors who had been engaged in a walkout, who under Yoon's decree were ordered to return to work within 48 hours. So the move was also anti-union as well as anti-democracy. Just after 1 a.m. in Seoul on Wednesday morning, that's 11 a.m. Eastern time on Tuesday, dozens of troops who had entered the main parliamentary building prior to the vote were seen withdrawing, according to Korean media. Citizens outside the building cheered when the news of the news came of the lawmakers' vote to shut down Yoon's decree of martial law just within hours after it being adopted. With some shouting, quote, "Long live the Republic of Korea," and chanting for Yoon to step down. As noted, the chief of Yoon's own political party, and this was it seems to me that it was key here. He didn't even have the support of his own party in declaring martial law. The chief of his own party, the People Power Party, condemned the move, condemned what he did, and said that the declaration was, quote, "wrong," and that he would, quote, "block it together with rival lawmakers," according to Yonhap. Which is how you hold off a dictatorship, with parties, opposition parties, coming together to protect democracy. Michelle Yeelee-Hee, Washington Post's Tokyo Seoul bureau chief, reported on Blue Sky on Tuesday that it took only about 2.5 hours for the National Assembly to gather a majority of members, a quorum, 190 of 300 members, and generate a unanimous vote, 190 out of 190, to vote down the emergency martial law. She says the law says that the president, quote, "shall comply with parliament's vote," but doesn't specify a time frame. But now it looks like it took just a matter of hours after the vote for Yoon to concede that he had lost this bid to this power grab. But Ryan Cooper, also over on Blue Sky, the managing editor of the American Prospect, we had him on the show a few weeks ago. He responded to Michelle He's report on Blue Sky by quipping, quote, fondly recalling how after January 6th, Congress went home for a long weekend and they didn't start impeachment proceedings for a week, which then took another month. Acting quickly was key in South Korea. Acting slowly, I think, was fatal ultimately in this country after January 6th. In other words, preventing a coup or stopping a coup and holding the coup plotters accountable requires quick work and both major parties actually caring to do so. That appears at least to be what is happening in South Korea as we go to air. All of which seems an important lesson for us. Never mind January 6, 2021. But a lesson now, moving forward into whatever unknown future that we may see in this country with a right-wing, autocracy-inclined president, is that fair to say?
Very.
Who narrowly won his election and who may, as we saw the last time he was in office, who may see his poll numbers quickly plummeting after taking office and suddenly become willing to take extraordinary measures to shore up his power and his plans. Even if it means invoking, you know, extraordinary measures like the Insurrection Act or other rarely used emergency powers, emergency or not, that end up invoking the military to support him. And yes, of course, that takes a military that is willing to play along, which is no doubt why Donald Trump has tapped a right-wing loyalist stooge like Fox News host Pete Hegseth to be his Secretary of the Defense Department, a man with no history whatsoever at the Pentagon, but a history of advocating in favor of, you know, convicted war criminals in the military, literally. And who, we have recently learned over the past several days, has a long history as an accused rapist. He's an inveterate womanizer and a sloppy public drunk. He's also a man who was kicked out from two different from the leadership of two different tiny nonprofit veterans groups for all of the reasons mentioned above and his fiscal management of the tiny groups before Trump tapped him to run the 3 million person strong Department of Defense with an $800 billion annual budget as the largest organization in the United States. So that should go well. But what we also learned from South Korea is that autocracy can be stopped dead in its tracks if leaders from the major political parties come together to stop it. Neither of the two political parties was powerless to take action, and apparently both did so. And they did so quickly on Tuesday, and that may have saved liberal democracy in South Korea today.
And it also helped to have swift and ferocious public opposition.
That didn't hurt. So as noted, you know, stick a pin in this particular story on Tuesday out of South Korea, which sort of came out of nowhere. But stick a pin in it because it does seem like an object lesson. It does seem like it might, and I hope it doesn't, but it does seem like it might become useful here in this country in the not too distant future. And it's even a lesson that might be useful right now in a number of battleground states where critical fights for power and against power grabs are currently underway. From South Korea to North Carolina and Wisconsin and even if time, Minnesota. And oh yeah, back to South Korea and even to Azerbaijan in Desi Doyen's latest Green News Report. Yep. All of that is still ahead on today's broadcast. I'm Brad Friedman.
The broadcast and the Green News Report are 100% independent, 100% listener-supported. But we can't do it alone. We need you. Please help us bring real facts to listeners at independent stations around the nation. Please drop by bradblog.com/donate. That's bradblog.com/donate. And thanks.
Hey, this is Brad. You're listening to an encore presentation of the Bradcast.
Clear the gallery. Just clear the gallery. Everybody's got to go.
We should be focused on what is going to make the lives of North Carolinians better, and what would do that the most right now is more relief for Western North Carolina. Instead, what we get are power grabs.
We felt like it was necessary that they know that we're watching. You know, this is our house, and we have a responsibility to show up and educate them.
Power to the people of North Carolina and South Korea. Welcome back to the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. All right, one of the big success stories for Democrats on November 5 was in the great battleground state of North Carolina, where, though Donald Trump was again declared the winner of that state, Democrats won a whole bunch of statewide offices on the ballot, including governor, lieutenant governor, attorney general, superintendent of public schools, secretary of state. Democrats also, at long last, flipped enough seats in the wildly gerrymandered North Carolina State House to finally take away, well, not Republicans' majority there, but their supermajority in the body, which the GOP had been able to use in both chambers of the state legislature to override the current Democratic governor Roy Cooper's vetoes. Beginning in January, Republicans will be just one vote shy of that supermajority in North Carolina. And though it's just one seat, it could have a major impact on schools and on taxes, healthcare, elections, and much more in the state, as the next newly elected Democratic governor, Josh Stein, takes his seat in the executive mansion, which is why, at the moment, in the few weeks that they have left with supermajorities in both chambers down in North Carolina, the Republicans there are fighting like hell to strip as much power as possible from the incoming Democratic statewide officials, as they hope to undo or at least undermine voters' decisions by stripping power from incoming Democrats by any means possible, rather than, you know, trying to work with Democrats to adopt policies that are supported by the people, that don't require a supermajority to overrule the governor. Support all of the people rather than just their own party. Emily Singer over at Daily Coast helpfully summarizes the ongoing situation, this ongoing attempted power grab, nicely in her coverage today. Republicans, she writes, in the North Carolina State Senate on Monday, overrode Democratic Governor Roy Cooper's veto of a bill that is a blatant attempt to steal power from Democrats and give it to the GOP-controlled state legislature. Republicans crafted this bill in secret. They held no hearings on it, and they passed it in November in both chambers, less than 24 hours after it had been made public. The vote came after Democrats won the governor's mansion and attorney general position in the state for the third cycle in a row, as well as the races for lieutenant governor, state superintendent of public instruction, and secretary of state. Republicans originally claimed the bill back in November was about Hurricane Helene recovery funding, but it contains very little of that. Instead, it takes power from incoming Democratic statewide officials. Republicans passed it. The Democratic Governor Roy Cooper, the current one, vetoed it. And now Republicans are racing to try to override his veto before losing the necessary supermajorities to do so next month. The bill, among other things, removes the governor's ability to appoint members of the state board of elections and requires that a governor fill judicial vacancies. This is amazing. Fill judicial vacancies at both the appeals level and the state Supreme Court level with only judges who are approved first by the party that the outgoing judge belonged to. So, you know, if a vacancy opens up for any reason on the state Supreme Court, from a justice who was a Republican, well, that seat must be replaced by a Republican judge approved by the Republican Party, even if the Democrat, even if the governor is Democratic at the time under this new bill. It also takes control of the State Utilities Commission from the governor and tries to hamstring the state attorney general from pursuing cases that are, quote, contrary to or inconsistent with the position of the General Assembly. In this case, that would be a Republican-controlled General Assembly who could then prevent the Democratic attorney general from filing lawsuits against, you know, oil and gas, and because this is North Carolina, coal companies in the state. Additionally, the measure blocks incoming state superintendent of public instruction, Mo Green. Here's a deep cut for Godfather fans. Not that Mo Green. It stops Mo Green from appealing decisions that are made by the North Carolina Charter School Review Board, a board that supports private charter schools and their use of public money to send wealthy kids to private schools. In a statement explaining his veto of the measure, Governor Cooper said, quote, "This legislation is a sham. It does not send money to Western North Carolina, which was hard hit by Hurricane Helene, but merely shuffles money from one fund to another. This legislation was titled Disaster Relief, but instead violates the Constitution by taking appointments away from the next governor for the Board of Elections, the Utilities Commission, and commander of the North Carolina Highway Patrol, letting political parties choose appellate judges and interfering with the Attorney General's ability to advocate for lower electric bills for consumers." The state Senate has already voted to override Cooper's veto. The state House, where Republicans are set to lose their veto-proof gerrymandered majority next month, when the new lawmakers who won in November are sworn in, well, they must now also override the veto, which is why you heard the protests, which is why you heard disgraced Lieutenant Governor Mark Robinson trying to clear the chamber as protesters are trying to prevent this massive power grab from happening. Protesters have been filling the legislative chamber in North Carolina, attempting to block the power grab in scenes that are reminiscent, for those of us old enough to remember, of similar battles at the Wisconsin State Assembly back during the Governor Scott Walker regime 13 years ago, which, by the way, we will return to in a second, believe it or not. But the legislature in North Carolina up until now has been able to override all 11 of Cooper's other vetoes, according to the Raleigh News and Observer. Some Republicans voted against this particular measure during its original vote in the House last month, and Democrats are hopeful that those lawmakers will do so again on this upcoming vote to override Cooper's veto in the days ahead. The measure will also be what experts are describing as a, quote, recipe for disaster for state elections as well. As Kaya Himmelman reports at TPM over the weekend, although the legislation is mostly most overtly an attempt to shore up Republican power before the new term, the 132-page bill also includes provisions that would radically restructure the way that elections are run throughout the entire state. These election changes, according to experts and election administrators, will make it more difficult for election workers to carry out their responsibilities during the next election. And, of course, isn't that the whole point? She notes that every single county in the state and the State Board of Elections would see a complete reconfiguration with new personnel. Senate Bill 382 places a number of new burdens on election officials. For one, it compresses the time frame for counting of provisional ballots from the current 10 days that are required to complete it under current law to just a short 3-day window.
Whoa.
3 days.
3 days for people to come back and prove, yes, I am a registered voter. Yes, I can vote here.
In a letter to lawmakers expressing her concerns about the legislation, the director of the Brunswick County Board of Elections and president of the North Carolina Association of Directors of Elections, Sarah Levere, wrote that this new compressed timeline, quote, is not feasible for our office and risk compromising the accuracy and thoroughness of our work. To ensure the accuracy of our recommendations to the Board of Elections, our staff needs more time than the proposed 3-day window allows, she added. Condensing this process could lead to errors, jeopardizing the integrity of the election and voter confidence in the process. But of course, Republicans do not care. The measure also shortens the window that voters would have to cure ballots. That's the process of, you know, for example, if you forgot to sign your absentee ballot that you mailed in, the county might call you and let you know and give you the chance to come in and sign it. The bill gives voters until just noon on Friday after Election Day. So again, just 3 days to come in and fix their ballot if they made a mistake instead of the current 6-day window that current law allows, which will very likely lead to valid votes not being counted. Karen Brinson-Bell, the executive director of the State Board of Elections, said in a statement on the legislation, quote, State Board staff were not consulted about this significant piece of legislation that transfers authority of the State Board of Elections and makes substantial administrative changes that may make it impossible for the county boards of election to adequately ensure every eligible ballot cast is counted, especially in high turnout elections. And perhaps most notably, the bill gives the newly elected state auditor, Dave Bolick, instead of the newly elected Democratic governor or even the newly reelected Democratic Secretary of State, the authority over the state's 5-member election board. Why the state auditor? Well, the guy who just won that job happens to be one of the few Republicans who won statewide office in November. That's why. Which Republican won statewide office? All right, let's have him do it. Auditor? That's okay. No other state gives the state auditor this type of authority over state elections. Whether the power grab right now being attempted in North Carolina, whether that is successful or not, we will see. And of course, if it is, it will most likely be challenged. And if it is, it will most likely make its way up to the North Carolina State Supreme Court to be determined if it's actually constitutional. And that'll be before the state's high court, a state Supreme Court where liberals are currently outnumbered 5-2. Again, another supermajority for Republicans there. Following the November 5th election, Republicans are still fighting, however, to make that number 6-1. 5-2 is not enough. They want it to be 6-1 after a close election by one of the incumbent liberal justices. On Monday, North Carolina Supreme Court GOP candidate Jefferson Griffin requested a hand recount after he challenged thousands of ballots across the state in the tight race against his Democratic opponent, Justice Allison Riggs, who declared victory after an initial recount, a statewide machine recount. A couple of weeks ago, Griffin asked for a machine recount, which found that Riggs very narrowly won the election. On Tuesday, the North Carolina State Board of Elections announced that due to Griffin's request, it would randomly select precincts to conduct hand counts. And if the results differ significantly enough from the machine recount, then the board will order a statewide hand recount. Riggs, one of two liberal justices on the 7-member court, was appointed by Democratic Governor Roy Cooper back in September of 2023. Now her race against Griffin, a judge on the North Carolina Court of Appeals, is extremely close. Riggs currently leads Griffin by less than 1,000 votes out of more than 5.5 million cast on November 5. But when Griffin requested the machine recount, he also challenged the validity of over 60,000 ballots, including ones from voters who had prior felony convictions, people whose voter registrations, he argued, are somehow incomplete, as well as military and overseas voters. Challenging all of those, 60,000 votes. Riggs said in a post to Twitter on Monday, quote, recounts are a normal part of the process in a close race. What isn't normal is the way my opponent is attempting to engineer a new outcome by challenging more than 60,000 votes across our state. My opponent is relying on legal theories that have already been dismissed by our state board of elections, as well as state and federal courts, to try and toss votes instead of simply conceding, Riggs said in a post in her post on Twitter. That said, gotta say, I don't really blame Griffin here for seeking a hand count, hand recount in a race this close, 1,000 votes out of more than 5.5 million cast. And frankly, he should have demanded one in the first place. I don't know if North Carolina law allows it or not. You'll be shocked to learn that the machine recount found the results to be exactly what they were when the machines counted the ballots in the first place. So, yeah, I think a hand count in this case is perfectly appropriate. And they're sort of doing it like a risk-limiting audit, which is a process where you count a few random precincts. And if the results differ from the original count, then you expand that count until potentially, eventually, counting the entire state. Sounds like they're doing something similar to that in North Carolina here. So we will see what happens in those counts in the days ahead. Happily, they've got hand-marked paper ballots to count and humans with eyeballs to count them in the state.
To verify that the machines got it right or wrong.
In the meantime, if the North Carolina GOP power grab bill is challenged in state courts, that case could end up in front of the North Carolina Supreme Court, which just happens to now still be missing a justice even after a month after the 2024 general election because of these challenges. So I do expect the Republicans will try to stretch out this fight over the results as long as possible. But it is another good reminder. Every vote matters. And I got another story to prove that in a moment. But first, North Carolina is by no means at this point the only state where Republican legislators have tried to take power away from their state's Democratic governor after losing elections like this. This is becoming normal, but it sort of was invented, it seems to me, in Wisconsin. They've been doing this for years now. Earlier this year, Wisconsin Republicans tried to strip Democratic Governor Tony Evers of his power to spend federal dollars by putting a measure on the August primary ballot that would have amended the state constitution to require legislative approval for the spending of all federal funds. Voters happily rejected that effort by a 15-point margin. In 2018, after Republicans lost the gubernatorial mansion in Wisconsin, Republicans at that point stripped power from Governor Evers and then incoming Democratic Attorney General Josh Call before they took office, just like what we're seeing in North Carolina. The legislation took away Evers' ability to remove work requirements for food stamps and health care. It tried to block Call's ability to withdraw the state from a lawsuit that the Republican Attorney General had filed against the Affordable Care Act. Republicans admitted at the time that their legislation to do that was simply an effort to hamstring the Democratic governor's ability to adopt his agenda. That power grab was eventually overturned by the courts, but this has been going on for years in Wisconsin. And speaking of Wisconsin courts, in a story that we have only been covering for, well, 13 years at this point, Wisconsin Public Worker and Teachers Union scored a huge legal victory on Monday this week with a ruling that restores collective bargaining rights that they lost under a 2011 state law that at the time sparked weeks of protests, made the state the center of the national battle over union rights. You may remember it. I know we've got some listeners to this show and readers of the Brad blog who have been following us that long, and they probably remember it well. We covered it as it happened 13 years ago when the Republicans stripped the union rights from thousands of public workers. It was a huge battle. And for now, anyway, 13 years later, it looks like the good guys, the unions here, may have appear to have won this fight, at least for now. That law, known as Act 10, effectively ended the ability of most public employees to bargain for wage increases and other issues and force them to pay more money for their health insurance and their retirement benefits. It was described at the time as Wisconsin's union stripping bill, and it radically cut into the power of unions in the Badger State, which is where the union movement in this country first grew. So it was a huge loss at the time for collective bargaining under the thuggish administration of then Republican Governor Scott Walker. Under Monday's ruling by Dane County Circuit Judge Jacob Frost, all public sector workers who lost their collective bargaining power would have it restored to what it was in place prior to 2011. They would be treated the same as the police, firefighter, and other public safety unions that were at the time exempted under that law. Those unions were exempted at the time, essentially because, well, they supported Scott Walker. But, you know, the teachers' union did not. Former Governor Scott Walker, who proposed the law that catapulted him onto the national political stage, decried Monday's court ruling in a post on Twitter as, quote, brazen political activism. And you know how Republicans hate brazen political activism by the courts. Whether it's the courts or the state legislatures, we know you hate that sort of thing, right, Scott? Do you think we do not remember what you did while in office, Scott? The law was proposed by Walker. It was enacted by the Republican-controlled legislature in spite of massive protests at the time that went on for weeks that drew as many as 100,000 people to the Capitol. The law, in the meantime, after being pushed through, has withstood numerous legal challenges over the years, but this was the first one brought since the Wisconsin Supreme Court has flipped to liberal control back in 2023. This was not before the Supreme Court, at least not yet. In this case, it was a district judge, Judge Frost, who sided with the unions. He said the law violates equal protection guarantees in the Wisconsin Constitution by dividing public employees into general employees and public safety employees. He ruled that general employee unions, like those representing teachers, cannot be treated differently from public safety unions that were exempted from the law because they supported Scott Walker. The ruling on Monday delineated dozens of specific provisions in the law that must now be struck. Republicans vowed to immediately appeal the ruling, which ultimately is likely, yes, to go before the Wisconsin Supreme Court, where last year, for the first time in a decade or more, I can't remember, Democrats finally won back a majority, a liberal majority, a narrow 4-3 liberal majority on the state's high court. So that is all good news. The other news is that all of this only amplifies the importance of, yes, another upcoming Supreme Court election in Wisconsin in April that will determine whether the court remains controlled 4-3 by liberal justices or not. Yes. Another Wisconsin Supreme Court election ahead, something else that I think we've been covering for about 20 years at this point.
Yep.
It's almost like, one can never stop fighting for democracy or something. What's up with that? And as I said, it's also like every vote matters. And if that ain't enough to convince you, and if the fight in North Carolina in the state legislature this week ain't enough to convince you, check out this fight for power in another closely contested state legislature following the November 5 election. Minnesota Republicans filed a lawsuit on Monday to try and force a rerun, a special election, of a state house race where the incumbent Democrat won by 14 votes. 14 votes. Which is amazing enough, but in which investigators concluded that that election workers probably destroyed 20 valid absentee ballots after failing to count them. Oops, that's a problem. But here's the deal. This one single race could determine the balance of power in the Minnesota House, where leaders from both parties are currently working out the details of a power-sharing agreement that currently presumes there will be a 67-67 tie in the House when the new legislature convenes next month. A Republican victory in a newly called special election, if that happened, that would then shift the balance to a two-vote 68-66 GOP majority. So yeah, this one seat really matters. Over in the Minnesota State Senate, Democrats have a one-vote majority there. So regardless of the outcome in the disputed House race, Minnesota will be returning at least to some degree of divided government in 2025 after 2 years of full Democratic control. The Star Tribune reports that if the parties end up sharing power in the House, as they would under the current premise that the Democrat who was announced the winner by 14 votes last week, if he ends up winning this race, it would be the first time for an even power share between the two parties in the state since 1979. Democratic Rep. Brad Tabke was declared the winner last week of the swing suburban how do you say it? Shakopee. I think it's Shakopee.
Okay.
Shakopee. That's it. Shakopee Area District. You don't need to write me from KTNF. I got it. It's the Shakopee Area District. Unless I'm wrong, feel free to write me. anyway, he was determined to be the winner by 14 votes after a recount and the official canvass. The race has been tightly contested since Election Day, when Tabke appeared to actually have just a 13-vote lead over Paul. A few days later, after election night, Scott County officials rescanned some of the ballots in Shakopee after a scanning machine malfunction had occurred, and the updated official results ended up increasing Tabke's advantage over Republican Aaron Paul from 13 votes to 14 votes. But Scott County election officials had said earlier after a post-election audit that they were unable to account for about 21 absentee ballots in the district southwest of Minneapolis. County Attorney Hosevar, we'll go with that. The county attorney reported last week that his preliminary investigation determined that election workers most likely threw out at least 20 of those absentee ballots accidentally. He wrote that they were most likely will not be recovered at this point, and even if they were found, it's unlikely that an unbroken chain of custody could be proven to assure that those 20 ballots in this race with a 14-vote margin were not actually tampered with. In Minnesota, the way it works, apparently, is that absentee voters complete their ballots. They place them into a security envelope to protect their privacy. Then they place that envelope into a signature envelope with their identifying information on the outside, so that election workers can check those ballots in. Once the counting begins, the ballots are supposed to be removed from the security envelopes, which are thrown away, and the votes tabulated. But the county attorney concluded that the 20 ballots for all from the same precinct were properly accepted for counting, but most likely were never removed from their secrecy envelopes before they were thrown away.
Mm-mm-mm.
The attorney cited human error as the cause for the tossed ballots. He said on Monday that the investigation is ongoing. The investigation did not determine what happened to the 21st ballot, so 20 were thrown away. The 21st ballot was cast in a different precinct. Officials opted not to look into that because they said it's not unusual that, for one voter to check in but not cast their vote. Minnesota House Republicans filed a lawsuit on Monday on behalf of the GOP candidate, Aaron Paul, asking a court to declare the results invalid and that Tabke's seat is currently vacant, calling for a special election, saying the, quote, undisputed facts make it impossible to rely on the current results. And frankly, it's hard to argue with them here. A 14-vote margin with at least 21 known ballots to be thrown out or their whereabouts unknown. Yeah, I got to say, they got a point. Now, that said, House Democrats think they are going to win this court challenge by the Republicans, so we will see. If they don't win it, and then the Democrat Tabke appeals the district court's decision, then the matter would go directly to the Minnesota Supreme Court. Court decisions would then be forwarded, whatever the court decides, would then be forwarded to the Minnesota House for a legislative hearing, according to state statute, where, as you will recall, the two parties are currently tied 67 to 67. So that should be fun. State constitutional crisis, anyone? Green News Report, straight ahead on the broadcast. I'm Brad Friedman. Hey, this is Brad. Please consider supporting whichever progressive media outlet is serving you. Most, just like us, do not receive corporate or political support. We all need your support to counter the powerful corporate media echo chamber. From Desi Doyen and myself, thank you.
You're listening to an encore presentation of The Bradcast.
Welcome back to the broadcast. Desi Doyen, as you can tell, I've got a lot to catch up with after a week off regarding elections and everything else.
Yeah, no kidding.
After Thanksgiving, as do you, I think, in our latest Green News Report.
Plastic pollution is just not a crisis. It is an assault on our planet.
UN plastic treaty negotiations collapse in Busan, South Korea.
The amount that is proposed is a paltry sum. It is not something that will enable conducive climate action.
UN COP29 climate talks in Azerbaijan end with weak agreement. Plus, extreme drought is an immigration issue, study warns.
All of those issues and more straight ahead from bradblog.com. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment.
President-elect Trump's pick for energy secretary is an oil and gas executive from Colorado who says the bright side of climate change is that all of the deaths from the increased heat will be more than offset by fewer deaths from the cold.
See? Everything's fine. We're back. This is your Green News Report. I'm gonna soak up the sun. Okay, Desi Doyen, a whole lot of negotiations out there and a whole lot of, well, failed negotiations as we return from the Thanksgiving holiday.
Yes, we will get to that in a moment.
Good.
But first, record-breaking extreme snowfall paralyzed parts of the Great Lakes and Northeast over the holiday weekend, accompanied by a blast of frigid air spilling out of the Arctic, some areas seeing more than 5 feet of snow. Studies show that man-made climate change is intensifying precipitation, including snow, because a warmer atmosphere holds more moisture. The snow blast may help counter deep drought that has triggered wildfires in the Northeast.
And that's the cold that Donald Trump's energy secretary says is going to save us somehow.
Yeah. The record-breaking 2024 Atlantic hurricane season is officially over after killing hundreds of people in the U.S. and causing hundreds of billions of dollars in damage. Fueled by record warm ocean waters, the season began with record-breaking Beryl in June, the earliest Category 5 hurricane ever recorded, and generated a record 7 hurricanes after the season's typical peak, the most ever observed between late September through November, with 3 landfalls in Florida, including major devastating Hurricane Helene, followed by Milton just 2 weeks later. A new study finds that extreme drought in Mexico is contributing to an increase in undocumented migration between Mexico and the United States.
Mm-hmm.
Over the last year, 76% of Mexico was in deep drought, and the country was hit with a persistent, deadly, record-shattering heat wave that decimated crops. The researchers warn more migrants could risk their lives to cross the border as the climate crisis generates more severe droughts, heat, heat, storms, floods, and crop failures.
Well, that'll be fun for the Trump administration.
While we were out, the COP29 climate treaty negotiations in Azerbaijan concluded with a weak agreement in which wealthy nations that got rich off of fossil fuels pledged to reach $300 billion per year in support by 2035 to developing nations. But that's far less than the $1 trillion per year that independent economists estimate is necessary to adapt to accelerating damages from climate-intensified disasters and to transition away from the fossil fuels that cause climate change.
$1 trillion a year?
Yes,
yikes.
It's a lot.
Yeah.
Without that financing, developing nations will not be able to shift away to clean energy fast enough to avoid the worst impacts of man-made global warming.
How fast are we going to shift away from it?
That's an excellent question.
Thank you.
Because UN rules require unanimous agreement, oil giant Saudi Arabia was able to block inclusion of a previous commitment to end the use of fossil fuels. But the nations did establish rules for a global carbon market for countries to trade emissions credits that is expected to unlock billions of dollars in revenue for conservation and mitigation projects in the developing world. But a different summit in South Korea, aimed at producing the world's first legally binding UN treaty to rein in plastic pollution, ended in failure on Monday. A handful of oil producers, led by Saudi Arabia and Russia, blocked a key agreement to put a cap on plastic production. They argued that the world should instead just target plastic pollution. But less than 10% of plastic is recycled, and plastics are made from oil and gas. Many oil companies plan to increase plastic production to boost their bottom lines. Production of plastic is on track now to triple by 2050. Microplastic pollution has been found literally everywhere on the planet, and in animals, human brains, and organs. Negotiators say they will resume the talks again next year. Delegate Juan Carlos Monterrey Gomez of the Panama delegation called the collapsed talks a moral failure.
Plastics are poison. Every piece that we allow to produce without limits is a direct assault on our health, on our nature, and our children.
For much more on all of those stories and the ones we couldn't get to today, check out our website at greennews.brandblog.com. I'm Brand Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report.
It's too much to breathe, all alone in this plastic jungle.
Boy, howdy.
Yeah, that's a lot of plastic out there.
Thank you very much, Desi Doyen. Thanks
yes.
to all of you for spending a portion of your day or night with us. If you missed any portion of today's program, you can download it anytime for free, as always, at bradblog.com. That service is made possible by those of you kind enough to hit one of those donate buttons while you're at bradblog.com. And hey, if you missed your Giving Tuesday chance to give to your friendly neighborhood broadcast, let me tell you, it is not too late. Just hit one of those donate buttons and you'll be a Giving Tuesday hero. Or you can go straight to bradblog.com/donate. Drop me email if you like. I am bradcast@bradblog.com, and you will find me and Desi on the social medias, most of them anyway. I am the Brad Blog. She is
at Green News Report.
And that includes now Blue Sky,
yes.
which is way better than Twitter. So go
true.
Find me at the Brad Blog, her at Green News Report over at Blue Sky. That's it. We will see you at all of the above until we see you here again next time, hopefully tomorrow. I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world. I wanna get